thank you for inviting me and for allowing me to speak. What we're talking about, I guess, tonight is activism, and I'm going to broaden that slightly and talk about what it means to be an engaged citizen, because whether you define yourself as an activist or not, you are thrust into the society, and the question is, what are you going to do about it, and what is your responsibility as a human being, as a member of a human community, and as a person living right here, right now. So one of the things I think I'll try to do is talk a little bit about the moment we're living in and a little bit about the historical moment we're living through, swimming through, and what's required of us in a moment like this. So let me start, though, by looking backwards just briefly. You know that this is the 150th anniversary of John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. Some of you know that, which was something that is, you know, been argued about for 150 years, what the meaning of it was. But I think if we go back a little bit further than that, go back 180 years or 200 years, I mean, let me just get a reading from you. You all are against slavery, right?
Yes.
A little more vigor. Yes, okay, good. I was worried. Of course you're against slavery, because we all are, because that's pretty easy. Now let's go back 180 years. 180 years ago, would you have been against slavery? I mean, if you were a captive person from Africa, I think you would have been against it. But what if you were living in Boston, or what if you were living in Alabama, or what if you were living in Georgia, and you were a white person? Would you have opposed slavery? Well, let's give ourselves credit. Let's say, yes, we would have all been diehard abolitionists, and we would have been a great group here at Northeastern. But if you think about it, 180 years ago, if you were opposed to slavery, you were also against the Constitution, you were against the law, you were against the Bible, tradition, your preacher, your parents, your friends, your neighbors. You were pretty much living a life of resistance 180 years ago, if you were opposed to slavery in the United States. And Henry David Thoreau got it just right. He said, we're not a society with a little anomaly called slavery. We are a slave state. That's what Thoreau said. He said, the only place for a free person in a slave state is prison. And he went to prison. Okay, it was only for a day, but still, it was that act of civil disobedience, that act of resistance, an act of opposition. But, you know, think about it. 180 years ago, it would have been hard work to oppose slavery. By 150 years ago, of course, the abolitionists were growing in power and so on. But let's pause there for a minute. You're all in favor of a woman's right to vote, right?
Yes.
There was a lot of enthusiasm. Woo! Right on. Okay. We're all for that. But again, go back 100 years. If you were in favor of a woman's right to vote 100 years ago, you were against the law, you were against your parents, you were against the Bible, you were against your preacher, and you were living a life of opposition. People did, activists did, engaged people did, but you were somebody who was bucking common sense and bucking the way that the world was, because the way the world was, the natural way that the world was patriarchal. The natural way the world was at a certain point was slavery. And I bring all that up to ask us, what are we missing today? What are we not seeing? What's just common sense to us today? Like, for example, we're about 1 year from the election of the first African-American president in the history of this country, a pretty significant and interesting development. No? Pretty interesting.
Yes.
And think back 2 years, that was unimaginable. But now it's something that's happened. But think ahead now, 40 years, and imagine your granddaughter saying to you, were you alive when the first African-American president was elected? And you'll say, yes. And did you vote for him? Oh, yes. Were you in Grant Park? Certainly. And did you go to Washington the inauguration? I was there. You could say that. Nobody will know. There were too many people. But you could tell your granddaughter all that if things work out well, which is not guaranteed. But you could say you were there. And then what if your granddaughter says, but is it true that it cost him $500 million to win that election, and you call that a free democracy? What will you say? You'll say, well, I know, but he raised it on the internet. I mean, what are you going to say, right? I mean, and she's going to challenge you, and she's going to say, really, that was your common sense, that free elections meant that billionaires had to kind of monitor the thing? That's pretty crazy, if things turn out a certain way. Or imagine your granddaughter saying, is it true that when you were a student at Northeastern, that 2.3 million of your fellow citizens were in prison? And you'll say, well, yeah, but there was a big, what will you say? There was a big crime wave? And it makes me think, it makes me wonder, you know. Here we are today saying, yeah, back then it was bad times and it was a slave state. Maybe we live in a prison state. Maybe we live in a state that can be defined by the fact that we have this gulag. Maybe that's how we should think about it. And if we think about it that way, maybe we should be uneasy about what we take for granted, uneasy about the ways in which these things become normalized. And we think, we buy the kind of idea that because we want to be safe, public safety requires us to lock up 2.3 million of our fellow citizens. Or let me take another issue. Are we made safe by the fact that we have a $1 trillion military budget? Does that make us safe? We spend as much on our military budget as the rest of the world put together. And I heard, you know, sometimes some of you, I'm sure, hear the delightful and kind of sweet and lovely Scott Simon on the radio on Saturday mornings. You ever hear Scott Simon? Sweetest guy in the world. Last Saturday, he was talking about the economic crisis, and he said in kind of a throwaway line, the one area of America that's always a growth industry is the military, because we live in a dangerous world. And on Scott's tongue, that naive statement sounded so cute, so sweet. Because we live in a dangerous world, the military is always a growth industry. Now, so you could kind of expand that. Because we live in a dangerous world, we export more handguns to the rest of the world than anybody else. Because we live in a dangerous world, we have 150 military bases. Because we live in a dangerous world, the Pentagon is one of the largest single polluters on Earth. But, or could we switch that around? Could we wonder, is that true? Could we ask ourselves, is that the right way to describe the causal relationship? Could we say, because of U.S. policy, we live in a dangerous world? Or could we say, a $1 trillion military budget doesn't make us safe? And again, I'm thinking forward 30 or 40 years and wondering if your granddaughter will ask you these things. You know, what sense do you make out of it when young people 40 years down the line look back and say, really, that was your common sense? All I'm saying is, and this gets me into the kind of heart of activism, is that the first requirement of anyone who wants to be an engaged person, an engaged citizen of the world, or an activist, is you have to open your eyes to the world as it is. And that's not something you do once and then go back to sleep. Opening your eyes is a constant kind of process. And it's step one in leading, I think, a moral life, but certainly leading an activist life. You have to open your eyes and see the world. Let me give you two kind of literary references that maybe make the point better than I'm making it. Have any of you ever seen the film Central Station from Brazil? Any of you? It won an Academy Award about 12 years ago, I think, as best foreign film. And I'll tell you the story because it's very simple. A woman makes a little extra money in the Central Station of Rio de Janeiro by writing letters for illiterate people. They come to her booth and she writes a letter and she makes a few pennies, and that's what she does all day long. And the film begins with a man coming to her who she's seen in the station, and he offers her $100 to take a day off of work and do an errand for him. And that's, wow, $100, of course. What's the errand? She has to pick up a 10-year-old boy from one part of Rio de Janeiro and transport him across the city to another part where he'll be adopted by an American couple. And Rio's like L.A. It's hard to negotiate, so it'll take her all day. But $100, pretty good. So the next day she does it. She picks up the boy. She transports him across Rio de Janeiro. She delivers him, gets the $100. And on her way home, she buys a color television and takes it to her very modest little apartment. And she's watching the TV, and her friends come over, and they say, where'd you get the TV? And she tells the story. And they say to her, Dora, are you that foolish? Do you really think that kid was being adopted by Americans? Don't you read the papers? That kid was sold on the international market for organ donors. He was killed. I'm sure he's been killed probably by now, but certainly in the next few days he'll be killed and his organs will be sold on the black market for organ donors. Now that's where the film begins. And of course, what does Dora do? Dora, of course, spends the rest of the film trying to retrace her steps to rescue the boy. Isn't that what we expect her to do? Isn't that what we want her to do? But if you think about the film metaphorically, it's a story about all of us. What don't we know? What aren't we seeing? What are we blind to when we look out in the world? What horrible things are happening right beneath the surface or right behind the veil that we're not paying attention to? And what would it take to know them? What would it take to find those things out? Take another example, a wonderful book by José Saramago, the Portuguese Nobel laureate, called Blindness. And it has a similar theme. The book opens, and it was made into a film recently also, not a bad film. But the book opens with a man stuck in traffic. And he's, you know, it's an annoying rush hour kind of urban scene, horns honking and all the rest. And he's at a stoplight, and he suddenly goes blind. And he can't see at all. He's overcome with blindness. And a little chaos breaks out, a little hell breaks loose. And somebody helps him from his car and then steals his car. And someone helps him home. And when his wife returns, she takes him to an eye clinic. Everyone in the eye clinic has gone blind. Everyone has been descended upon by this kind of mysterious affliction. And so they quarantine these people. And they put them, you know, behind a barrier, and they get soldiers to guard them. And slowly, 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 over the first 40 pages, everyone goes blind. First the soldiers, then people beyond the soldiers, and pretty much very, very quickly, everyone is blind. And what happens in their blindness, they group up into gangs, and they prey on one another. They steal food, they fight for lodging. Gangs of men rape gangs of women, and it becomes this horrendous, horrendous dystopic vision. And as it descends into the bottom rung, at one point the original guy, his eyes come back. He can suddenly see. And then within a very short time, everyone can see. And they're so happy. They embrace each other, and awkwardly, because they've been pretty nasty to each other. But then they raise the question, why did we go blind, and why can we now see? And the narrator at that point says, perhaps we didn't go blind. Perhaps we were blind. Blind people who can see, seeing people who are blind. And again, what Saramago is saying is that's us. That's our condition. It's not something that's happening in some fantasy or some novel. We are blind people who can see. Who doesn't know about the illegal wars that we've conducted in the last 8-10 years? We all know. So what are we doing about it? Who doesn't know about the AIDS catastrophe in Africa? We all know. So what are we doing about it? Who doesn't know about the incarceration rate and the fact that within, you know, 15 miles of this university, there are 12,000 African American men caged? We all know. And yet, this is the normal condition that we live in. And since we breathe it in as normal, we are blind to it. We don't see it. We don't see it in a moral sense. We don't see it in a human sense. And so all of that is to argue that if you intend to live a purposeful life and a moral life, and if you intend to live an activist life, the first responsibility is to open your eyes, to see what's there to be seen, and to try to make sense out of it. And really, I can describe, I think, very simply what it takes to be an activist for the long haul. And one is, you have to open your eyes. Two is, you have to be astonished. You have to be amazed at both the horror and the joy of it, the delight of everything around you and the ugliness of what's around you. And you have to see both, and you have to take in both. And then you have to act against what you find unacceptable, and then you have to doubt whether your actions were all that good. And then you have to open your eyes, be astonished, act and doubt again. And it's a continual circle. But that, it seems to me, easy to say, but very, very difficult to do. And that, it seems to me, is the requirement of engaged world citizenship, is that sense of looking, seeing, acting, doubting, acting again. So one of the things that I think marks us as human beings, but I think, again, if you intentionally take on the role of being an activist, is you have to start, and I think you have to nourish a politics of confidence, a politics of hope, a politics of possibility. And what I mean by that is, I know a lot of you are sociologists, or a lot of the folks I met coming in were sociology students. And it's one thing to look at the world as it is, but a politics of confidence tells you to don't just look at the world as it is, don't look at the world as it's given to you, but also look at the world as if it could be otherwise. Look at the world for what else could be true. So it's not just what is, it's what could be, what might be, what should be. It's seeing alternatives that stirs us to action. I mean, we wouldn't act if we thought there was no alternative. So we act because we see possibility. We see that there's something that can be done, that injustice can be opposed. And that, it seems to me, is where we have to start. I'm astonished, given the moment we're living through, that, you know, the Republican Party got its ass kicked in November a year ago and still acts as if they define the agenda, they set the terms, they get to make all the noise. And where is the opposition to that? On every issue that I can think of importance to me, maybe not everyone, but most issues of importance to me, I think that that I'm in the majority, and I don't feel like a minority. Too often, progressive people, people who see themselves in opposition, think that their opposition means they're in the minority. I don't think so. I think the majority of us are against the war. The majority of us think that GLBTQ people should have full equal rights. The majority of us think that we have too many folks in prison. And I think those are things that we ought to be organizing around actively, actively pushing in order to find that majority that does exist. In other words, allowing ourselves to kind of back ourselves into a corner and pretend that we represent some kind of precious but very arcane kind of ideas really is self-defeating. So go back to the last election. There were many things that were significant about it. But I want to point to two things that I think were important. One was that when Obama was asked during the primaries again and again, who would Martin Luther King support? Do you remember what his answer was when he was asked that during the debates? Yes, his answer was King wouldn't support any of us. King would be in the streets building a movement for justice. And the reason that's such an important answer, and an answer, incidentally, that only a community organizer, I think, could make, is it puts a charge onto us. So that it's not enough to say, oh, I wish Obama would end the war, or I wish Obama would bring us universal health care. The charge is to us. So every time you feel that impulse to say, why isn't Obama ending the war, you have to ask yourself, what did I do this morning to help build an anti-war movement? What did I do? What is my self-activity? Because I can't rely on people at the top to affirm me or to do what ought to be done. Think about it historically. Lyndon Johnson, the most effective politician of his generation, and who passed the most far-reaching civil rights legislation since Reconstruction, Johnson was a cracker from Texas who never was part of the Black Freedom Movement. And Franklin Roosevelt was never part of the labor movement. And Abraham Lincoln never belonged to an abolitionist party. So something was happening in those three moments in history that made those great things happen. But it wasn't the great men delivering to us what we, you know, what we need. It was us demanding of them that they do the right thing when the crisis hit and when it really mattered. That's where we are, in my mind, in this moment. We're in a moment of movement making. We're in a moment of trying to find the connections between the struggle, for example, for peace in the world, to get the United States to move in the direction of becoming a nation among nations and not the uber nation who, you know, lords its power over everyone. Get it to see, to back up from that. We can't do that without building a peace movement, but we can't build a peace movement without seeing the ways that peace is linked to immigrant rights, that immigrant rights is linked to universal health care, that universal health care is linked to opposing the demonization and scapegoating of GLBTQ people, and so on. If we don't see these links, we don't build a movement that really represents a real shift a real sense that social justice is a possibility. So what I want to urge you to do, and all of us to do, first I want to ask us to ask ourselves a large question, which is, how are we going to live our lives, not just this year and not just next year and not just when we're students and not just when we're young, but how are we going to live our lives in such a way that it won't make a mockery of our values? And that requires us to explicitly say what our values are. What is it we want to fight for? And if we can enunciate that, and that's a work in progress, and it's dynamic, and it's not something that's that simple, but it begins by saying, what do I want to stand for? Do I want to stand for peace in the world, in a violent, warlike world? Do I want to stand for peace? Do I want to stand as someone who in solidarity with people who are voiceless, who are marginalized? Do I want to be part of that community? How do I be part of that community? Do I want to stand for international perspectives as opposed to kind of a narrow nationalistic view of the world? Do I want to see the world large? And I say this intentionally to us as Americans. You know, the National Geographic did a survey of 18 to 25-year-old American kids. I don't know if you read this recently, but they did a survey, and 80% of 18 to 25-year-olds couldn't find a rock on a blank world map. 80% couldn't find Palestine, Israel. 40% couldn't find Great Britain. And 10% couldn't find the United States. Yeah, the last one gets to us because we could find the United States, and damn it, that's good. But it's really true. We kind of are geographically challenged, aren't we? Because we don't really see the rest of the world in quite the clarity that we see ourselves. But do I want to be that person? Do I want to have values that are internationalist, that see the world as equal, that sees all human beings of incalculable value and acts on that belief? That's hard, but it can be done. So tomorrow morning, if we agree, or if we can come to agree through discussion, that it's a worthy thing to try to live our lives in that way, then the question is, what do we do? How do we get up tomorrow morning? And one of the things I worry about with all of us is that we leave it to somebody else to do the work. And so I want to argue that every one of us has an equal responsibility. It's not just Obama, and it's not just Senator Durbin, and it's not just, you know, the so-called leaders. It's us. And our responsibility, it seems to me, every day, every week, every month, is to engage in at least three levels of activity. One is we should all be studying more. We should all be reading more books, more articles, more newspapers. We should be understanding the world more. And that involves, you know, starting a film series here on campus, or a book group, or a reading group, or writing positions, or starting a speaker series, which apparently you do. So studying, thinking is part of it, part of paying attention. Another part of it is organizing. And organizing means fundamentally speaking to strangers. It means not being satisfied to be with your group of friends, you know, in your basement smoking dope. There's nothing wrong with that, but I'm just saying, I'm not criticizing that. I'm just saying it's not enough. It's inadequate. Because you have to, it's good to be with people who you love and who love you and who you can agree with. But then those who love you and whom you love, you have to step outside the basement and you have to figure out a way to engage strangers in conversation, in activity, and that means, you know, pulling the silos together, getting out of the silo of the peace movement and the immigrant rights movements. It means bringing in more people into meetings like this. It means finding ways to get out of your comfort zone in order to address a broader public, and in that broader public to find allies, to find friends, to find people that you can also agree with. And then third, so it's study and organize, and third is to mobilize, to make yourself public, to publicly stand up for something. You know, there were two things that happened in the last couple days that blew me away, because you can't always predict what the right thing to do is. But if you sit around waiting for the perfect thing to do, you will be paralyzed. You have to move to do these things when they're not perfect. And you have to be agnostic about what's perfect. These are things you can do right now without having the perfect analysis and know the strategic thing, or even without making the calculation, if I do this, this, and this, the war will end. I don't have any idea when or how the war will end. I don't know, but I still want to get up tomorrow and work on it. I was born in 1944 when the atomic bomb was dropped, you know, and I've lived under the shadow of the atomic bomb my whole life, right? And so the question isn't, if I take a position against nuclear weapons, will I win? I haven't won yet, but I've been against nuclear weapons for my entire adult life. But it's who I want to be. In other words, activism is in part an existential question. I want to be a person who stands against nuclear weapons. I'm not sure what will work to end them. I'm more hopeful now than I've been sometimes, but I'm not hugely optimistic, you know, and I'll talk about that in a minute. But you have to decide to act even with imperfect knowledge. So two things in the last couple of days. One was, did you see the State Department person in Afghanistan's letter of resignation? Did you see this? Wow. This guy in Afghanistan wrote a letter that's all over the internet. It's been reported on CNN and everywhere. And this guy explained that it's not that things are going badly in Afghanistan. It's that it's wrong right from the start, everything about it. And he's a high official in the U.S. State Department in Afghanistan. And he quit and wrote a public letter that is incredible. So something stirring, right? There were these meetings where the government was having these hearings on universal health care. And groups of progressives who were fighting for universal health care stood up and disrupted them and sang songs. Did you see this? Oh, it was just lovely performance art. And I can't remember now. I won't be able to pull the tune up in my mind. We're going to have universal health care. Okay, never mind. But it was great. And what was great about it was it freaked out the Republicans who were holding these hearings. They said, we can't have a hearing with people singing like that. You know, well, it was very much like the teabag parties or whatever those things were. It was a small group of activists making noise. You can do that. It's not something that's impossible. It's something that you can do. So I'm urging you to kind of say to yourself, make a commitment to yourself, that it's more than just looking outward and expecting others to do for you. It's doing for yourself. I was talking with some students just before we began, and we were all evoking the memory of Jane Addams, the great, the great founder of Hull House, the first woman to win the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize in the 1930s, and an extraordinary person who fought for everything, all kinds of socially progressive things at the turn of the last century. She fought for the first, juvenile court in the world, which spread through the world like wildfire, fought for the eight-hour day, fought for immigrant rights, fought to for the kind of recognition of people's culture, fought for the first kindergarten, the first playground in a public park, and on and on and on. The first parole officers, Jane Addams and the women of Hull House fought for all those things. But the important thing to remember about Jane Addams was that Jane Addams did not work in service to the poor. She worked in solidarity with the poor. She moved into the neighborhood and saw their problems as her problems. She wasn't Lady Bountiful coming to people with the great solution. She was with them, working on the same issues. And it reminds me that we have choices to make as we go forward here in Chicago and into the new century and so on. We have a lot of choices to make. But one is, we can choose, because we're privileged people in many, many ways, we can choose to live in isolation and look at Chicago as dangerous. We can kind of lock our doors and kind of be paranoid and see everything as every stranger as somebody to fear. Or we can live in a kind of solipsistic Chicago, kind of an egocentric Chicago, where we say, isn't it wonderful? And we love the parks and we love this, but we ignore the real problems of the city. Or we can say, we want to build a relationship with each other and with the city that really is a relationship of love. And it's a relationship that says that, you know, what's good for the least of us is good for all of us, and what's good for the most privileged is good for all of us. And we have to kind of fight, I think, to see ourselves in solidarity with each other, working towards a world that's in balance, that's at peace, that is firmly rooted in principles of humanism and solidarity. And that's what I urge us all to do. So thank you very much.
Thanks.